History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and listen patiently as long-buried memories come to life once again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This episode was recorded at the VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, where 94-year-old Purple Heart recipient Lou Boria is one well-known Marine. We're going to hear how he lied about his age to get into the Marine Corps at age 16, but let's hear first about his childhood. So growing up in Brooklyn, New York, in a Puerto Rican family in the 1930s, what was that like?
I got to tell you, you want to hear a true story?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't Puerto Rican. I was F Puerto Rican all the time, especially after you started getting into the 13, 14 years old. You know, you get a little more than away from the kids' stuff. And it was constant challenges, every place you went, you know, guys, you want to go to the playground, you know, you don't belong here, there's enough Puerto Ricans here. And I told my wife one time about an incident. I went to a Manual High School, and a girl in the class, she was Polish, and we lived in the same building. So her father had told you, I don't want to have a kid talking to Puerto Ricans, this, and that, you know. So one day I lived in a building where they had a front and a back. They had six stories on this side, six stories on this side. I lived in the back part, and she was up in the front. Anyway, the thing is, I come in a hallway, and she was coming down the steps. And we started to talk something about the school, about school. Her father walks in. He gives her a slap in the face, knocked her over, dragged on her. I told you not to talk, nobody spoke English. These guys in broken English, they're telling us they're not this. And this is the way it was so constant, you know. I grew up, my father took off when we were kids. So my mom raised us, and I went to La Primera Iglesia Bautista de Habla Español in Brooklyn. And I grew up that way. My mom made sure every Sunday we went to church, and constantly says, you know, when you go to God's house, you put the best that you have. Then you go to God's house. So I continue that through my life that way. So anyway, my mom was, you know, like I said, you know, you live in a building where hardly anybody spoke English. And the thing that bothers me the most at the time was that we were the only Americans. Puerto Ricans, American citizens.
Yeah.
And 90% of the people that were always picking and putting you down, you know, they were all the aliens. Like I said, growing up in Brooklyn, you're exposed to all this kind of stuff. So it was good stuff, and it was bad stuff. Like, you couldn't communicate with the parents, but the parents would get these kids, and they would be the interpreters. I was talking with my wife one time, she says, at our church, the pastor had a list of names, and so if any one of the congregation had to go to hospital or something, they didn't speak English, so somebody on that list would have to go with that person to the, and sometimes you're just sitting in hospitals, you know, for that hour, that was days. I remember one time I went with a lady a day and a half before she got in to see somebody. And, you know, the people there, they didn't give a damn, you know what I mean? They treat people like you. So that it was hard for me, you know, growing up, to accept that kind of stuff, you know, because, this is later on, that I was able to learn how to be bold. You know, if you got a guy say something to you, you know, not to be a wise guy or a tough guy or anything, but, you know what I mean, have some kind of a defense without having to go into a fist fighting constantly. So my wife, she said, you know, you think you're a tough guy. I said, yes. I said, let me tell you, if I thought I was tough, I wouldn't be here today. So you had to be, you know what I mean? Where guys threaten you all the time. In our times, you didn't have jobs, so the only thing that you could do to make a buck, a couple of pennies or something, was a shoe shine. So I used to shine shoes Saturdays. And my mother wouldn't let me go on Sundays, but Saturdays and Friday nights I would. So I had to go to a barber shop, and I talked to the guy. I said, "Look, I'll clean up everything else. You let me put a shoeshine box outside, you know." So he says, "Okay." So I used to clean up and run errands for the guys and come back and shine shoes. So I said, maybe make 50, 60 cents a day, whatever. So it was change, you know. But at that time, you buy a bottle of milk, it was 8 cents, 5 cents, you know, things like that. So that a dollar was, you can buy some meat or something. So whatever help you gave. And at the same time, you gave me that little freedom. I have a couple of pennies. And so that I remember one time, I think about a dollar, 10 cents or something like that day. So the next day I went to Coney Island. And you could ride the trains for 5 cents. You get a Frankfurter for 5 cents. And you get a root beer for 5 cents. And they had a place there where they had all these rides. So for 50 cents, they would give you a ticket and you could get all the rides. So for a dollar, you spend the whole day. You know what I mean? So it was... Like, it was tough, you know, but not like clothes. You know, once you get to be 14, 15, you want nice clothes, but being on home relief, so you're on your war, whatever, they gave you that. So I got a job during the month in a factory. I had pipe, smoking pipe, like, and I worked on polishing the pipes, you know. So anyway, but by the time the summer was over, my mom was telling me, "You got to go to school." So I said, "Mom, I want to be able to buy something to wear to school, you know." And it's nice. So my mom used to take us to a Jewish guy. He had a basement, and he used to get shoes from all these different shoe companies. And then he would match them, tie them up, and put them in a match, like, you know, they look alike. And my mother would take for 15 cents to get a pair of shoes. And then she'd buy a can of dye in black, you know. So I had a pair of shoes, you know. But never, you know, a pair, you know, just match it. But anyway, but it was shoes. So it's coming towards the end of the summer months. So she keeps telling me, "You got to go to school." I said, "Mom, another week, just one more week, and then I'll go." So she got tired of hearing me. So she goes to back. So I don't know whether it was the pastor. Somebody advised her to go to the thing for the schools. So anyway, the next thing you know, I got a truant officer comes on the job and arrests me. So they lock me up, take me before the judge. They're saying about, mother's telling me to go to school. I don't want to go to school. So anyway, so I lock them up for two weeks, locked up in a juvenile.
And how old were you?
Oh, about 14, 15 maybe. Mm-hmm. So my mother bust out crying and screaming, you know. So they leading me away, and my mom is carrying on, you know. So anyway, they went to the back, and the pastor, and then, so it wound up, the judge misinterpret my, it wasn't that I was working, and that I was. So then when he explained everything to her, he says, "Okay." So the next morning they let me go. So, and I tell him, I says, "You know, you're going there, and you're in that, and I mean, it was fighting for the minute they locked me up and brought me in the back, slapping guys around and pushing you to get there. You go to eat, they want to push you and get in front of you." And so I was, from the minute I was battling. So the guy said, "What the hell are you?" I said, "What am I going to do with this guy?" You know, he said, "You're blaming me. What about them?" So anyway, I was able to get out. And that's that kind of life. We had a swimming pool down there, used to call Red Hook. And you get down, the Italian guys, you come over, they want to mess around with your sisters, but they didn't want you. The girls okay, but the guys, you know. So anyways, so the thing started battling with this. So one day they took this girl and they threw her off the diving board, you know, and she didn't know how to swim. But anyway, we got her out of the water. We went back and we got about 10, 15 guys. We tore that place up. I mean, really, put a lot of damage in it. But we got to say, you know, you don't want to give us a break. So it was kind of tough. So like I said, getting into the Marine Corps was my lifesaver. I mean, we used to have the mafia. They come over to you, they tell you, "You see that over there? They take you to the house. You throw garbage can through the window, we give you $5. $5. You know what that was like? Like $100. So little by little, they want to move you up to different. So finally, I says, you know, my mother used to come constantly. It's just like the Italiano ganguistas. Ganguistas used to stay away. But I said, "Mom, how could you? If I wanted to go to school, the school that we got out of the train station, it was in an Irish neighborhood. So the minute you come out of the train, they start out with you, you know, "Hey, Guinea, hey, Spicko," you know, they throw things at you. And so as you're walking down to get to the class, So then I had to join an Italian gang to go to school. It was really tough times living that game with my mom constantly, you know, being a good Christian. She was always hopping on me. So, well, you know, the war started, and then, so I was trying to say, you know, I want to go in the Marines. Like, we lived in the neighborhood. I don't know if you're familiar with Brooklyn, but anyway, the Navy Yard, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, we lived on Sand Street, and at the end of Sand Street was the entrance to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So every day, all you would see all day long were sailors, you know, drunk or neat. But the only thing I used to see the really neat with the Marines, the MPs. So they always look real classy and sharp, and I used to admire that. I said, that's how I want to be a Marine. So the guys, every time they thought, kid me about it. I says, hey, I live 3 blocks away from the Brooklyn Navy. That's sick and tired of seeing swabbies all the time, you know. So that's what I always kid the guys about it. But anyway, that's what I wanted. But I took my mom down to, I forget, you know, she don't understand English too well, so I guess I'm going to get over. So when they got there, she said, no, she told me, he's only 16. That's what the guy says, oh, you go ahead, go on home. And yeah. So I was talking to one of my friends about it, and he says, you know, why don't you go to the draft board? What you going to do? You tell them you're 16, and you tell them you're 17, and they sign you up right away. So I went to the draft board. I told them I was 17, so the guy says, well, sign papers, everything. And about a month later, I get it to report to the board, draft board. So I went down, take it all examined and everything else. In about another month or so, I got a letter. I'm classified 1A. So I get down to the draft board for induction. So they strip down, and you're in shorts and line up, get all in line. So the guy come up and he says, I need 5 guys, you know, the army guys. Okay, you 1, 2, 3, you 5 guys, you're in the army. So I said, this guy, the Navy guy, comes up and says, I need 10. So he comes up, he bump up a point, he says, you're in the Navy. I say, I ain't going no Navy. He says, you're going to, we tell you, you're going now, get over there. I said, I ain't going nowhere, I ain't going to go in the Navy. So the next thing you know, they got a cop, police. I said, hey, I don't know what the hell you're getting. I said, I didn't say I didn't want to go in the service. I said, I don't want to go in the Navy. I said, I want to go in the Marines. So this Marine corporal was walking by. He said, he's mine. So the next thing you know, I'm in Paris Island. So I get up at the Paris Island. And you know what you think? I went through prejudices. And you know what it was like in 1943 down in South Carolina. So you couldn't go drink water. The blacks and whites, you know, that kind of routine. I get off the bus, and he's roll call. Sorry. He walks up. You Indian boy? I said, no, sir. He said, what are you, Mexican? I said, no, sir. He says, yes. What are you? I said, I'm Puerto Rican. So he goes, you're what? I says, Puerto Rican. So he looks at this other side. He said, what the hell kind of disease is that? So anyway, I just put up with all that. But later on, I had to, you know, talk a lot of times with different positive people in the family. And I said, you know what? In the platoon that I was in, there's 45 guys. Every one of those guys was like a whole, like better than a brother. I mean, I had a guy that was in the bunk underneath me. I slept on the top bunk. And this guy was from West Virginia. He used to sit there and be talking. He tells me, you know, you talk funny. I said, I talk funny. I said, you take 10 minutes to say to a sentence. Y'all, moan. Everything was a moan, you know. And we just died. So, Sundays used to let you go to church. So, anyway, so Sunday was a routine day. So, that they said, okay, all the Baptists. And so I would be a Baptist. So, this guy, he was a Baptist, you know, from the Southern Baptist guy. So, we're in church and I don't know, somehow singing hymns. So I'm singing away, and he's staring at me, you know, but I'm singing in Spanish, and I don't realize it, you know. So they were singing this hymn, Pardon the Trauma, Tiene la sangre que dice, and I'm going away. And this guy's looking at me like, what this? So he goes back to the back, he says, this guy speaks 2 languages. He speaks 2 languages. So it was funny as heck. But we got along, and guys, everybody.
It's time for our first break, but we'll explore Lou's Marine Corps memories when we come back. He was awarded Purple Hearts in both World War II and the Korean War. Check out the photos of Lou online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Lou Boria. He lives in Florida now, but grew up in Brooklyn. Boot camp in Parris Island, South Carolina, as a 16-year-old who had fudged his age to get the draft board's attention, proved to be quite unforgettable.
This drill instructor, he comes with a lineup. Anybody that was in the Marine Corps at that time, a draftee, his serial number started with a 9-0. So he's looking, he goes, and he sees me. You're a draftee? You couldn't volunteer? You come into my Marine Corps? You effing this and that draft, I did this and that. I mean, this guy was with his finger, and he would never physical, I mean, but just jab you like this and sticking his finger. This was from that day on. He was, because I was a draftee, I wasn't a volunteer. But, I mean, not that only me. I mean, he was tough on anybody that went to the Marine Corps could tell you that. Boot camp, I mean, he was tough. It was many a time that I was, what a mistake. But these guys were unbelievable. I mean, they were so close to me. One of the funniest things that they, or not the funniest, one of the toughest things. I said, you know, you grow up at home. And in Brooklyn, you had apartment houses. And in between, like the hall, the apartments were this way in the hallway, right? At the end of the hallway was a bathroom. So when you used the bathroom, you put the latch on to the door from the other apartment. And when you got out, it would put the, then they would come in, they would put the light, you know, so that it was one bathroom for all this. So everybody had a party. So everybody had a little room in to go to when you had to go. So now you imagine you get to Parris Island and you get in the barracks and you go to the bathroom. And there's four bowls across this way, and there's four bowls this way. How do you sit down, pull your pants, and sit down and do this? And you're looking at a guy. I mean, it was. I don't think I was constipated for about a week and a half. I just couldn't go. I mean, you said that kind of thing. And that, you think that's bad? Try going to shower. Uh-huh. It's the same routine, five showers on that side and this side. Yeah. So it's funny, and it's tough, you know, to get over that. But anyway, boot camp was 12 weeks. I mean, these guys pounded on you. So there were times that I was really, 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 you know, at the end. But these guys would come, especially this guy from West Virginia. You know, he would be all over me, you know. And the guys, everybody, I don't think there was, none of these guys ever knew what a Puerto Rican was. I mean, they were all from Oklahoma, places like that. They weren't, no city guys. So anyway, in the Marine Corps, before you graduate, we have a parade, you know, and it's the first time you're getting into full dress uniform. And we had a sergeant, and like I said, that guy, he says, the color in here is Marine green. I don't want to hear anything about this, you know. And then he would be looking at me and telling all these guys, you know, but it wasn't needed. I mean, those guys, they were the best. The best.
I think what I hear you saying is that the first time in your life where you didn't feel discrimination was in the Marine Corps.
And the thing was, you know, in my time, the only guys that you could go to, men, were the church members. I couldn't come and tell them about what happened in the streets, you know what I mean? You had to mostly all the time find a solution by yourself. But anyway, getting back to, so you get your full dress uniform, and I'm telling you, these guys, when they put that, they have guys to measure your, when you put that on, that thing fits perfect. So that they have the parade, and once you pass the review, you get back, your bags are packed, everything is, and you get 10-day leave. So we went to the parade. When we get back, and all these guys were all hugging each other, and that we made it, you know, and they're all so happy. And I said, Boreal! Everybody freezes, you know. All the guys are looking at me like, they're not going to let this guy graduate. And so anyway, I run outside and stay there outside. So he walks over to me, and he sticks his hand out. He shook my hand. Well, anyway, he shakes my hand, and he tells me, you're going to be a good Marine. He said, but learn kind of control your temper. So I run back inside the barracks, and I come in, and the tears run down my face. I was so excited. And the guys thought that the guy had. So they come running over to me, like, you know, like, what happened? He shook my hand. They flipped out, everybody jumping and screaming and carried on. And that was like the big introduction to me with the Marine Corps. I mean, it was like the best thing I ever did in my life. You know, you go overseas, and yeah, that was the big turning point in my life when that guy told me. It made me feel like I was something. I was a man. You're a Marine. You know what I mean? And what a great feeling that was for me. I think I came home for boot camp. I think it was May. I was out on my way overseas. And we went through the Panama Canal to Hawaii and did all my training. And we went aboard a ship. He said, 53 consecutive days on a troop ship. I don't even, if you ever have any idea what it's like. I mean, you're getting 2 meals a day, no fresh water showers. You know, so where do you go? A couple of hundred guys on a ship. Where could you go? And in those days, they had no air conditioning. They had these big funnels on the ships on the front, and which the ship was facing where the wind was. You got some breeze down below, but if you didn't, forget about it. I mean, and then you're stacked up 5 and 6 high. I mean, it's horrible, really horrible. We hit a monsoon. I mean, the chains on the bunks snapped. Guys come down broken arms. I mean, busted heads, and it was really blood all over the place. It was really tough, tough, tough times. I come up out of the mess down. You had to go across the deck to get to the mess hall. So I'm standing there, coming up, and this officer's standing, and he holds me back. And as I have a help back, the ship, blades were spinning out of the water. The ship was tinted like this, and the ship was vibrating. So he's holding me back. All of a sudden, this mountain, I mean, I look out, there must have been 30, 40 feet high, just over the top of the ship. All the landing crafts that were on that one side of the tore them right off. So it was like a domino effect. This one hit this one, and the next thing you know, we're all gone. So now we're all saying, well, we're going to go to make the beach, and they got no boats. They sent boats from other ships. To make these invasions, they throw these nets over the side of the ship, and they bring these boats up alongside. Now, you know, you're out in the ocean, the waves. And so with this, boats are flat-bottom boats, so they're bouncing up and down. So you're coming off the net, you got a pack, rifle, ammunition, everything. Now you're coming down. All of a sudden, you go to put your foot, and there's no ship. The boat is down, so you got to dangle in there. And at the time, well, I was only a private, but later on, it was different. But anyway, usually the sergeants always go over first, and they get down, and they grab the net, and they hold it as taut as they can. But at the end of the time, their legs are flying in the air, and the boat's gone. So you're holding these guys, hold on, however, so that if they hear you with all the constant pounding and everything that's going on, you'd think that the world has gone crazy. So anyway, finally, you get a chance to get, and you drop into the boat. So you drop your buckle with all that weight, you know, and now you're waiting for the next guy. So you got to keep your helmets. The guys are, but anyway, you finally get the boat loaded up, and it pulls off. Now they go into what they call a rendezvous area. So whatever wave you're going to be in, depending on what's happening on the beach, if it's tough, they keep you out there. So anyway, they might have 7 or 8 boats. You ever go to the airport and smell a diesel? Imagine 8 boats, one right behind the other. So the next thing you know, everybody's puking. I mean, out on the floor, sick as a dog. And you look around, there ain't nobody standing there. All these guys are all laying out, they're all back and forth in all the puke. Every time that ship goes down, that stream of water back, you're soaking wet, puking all over yourself. They finally get the boat. They say, okay, they head in for the beach. You might have been in that rendezvous 45 minutes, an hour. You don't know. You lose time. Anyway, you get to the beach. It says, okay, get ready. It says, hold on, because when they hit that beach, the boat slams in, and everybody goes flying over. So they usually, what they do, they get the coxswain, they're about to reverse the engines, so it slows the boat down, so when it hits the beach, you don't pound, so the guys go flying. So anyway, we get go get off. And 90% of you always wind up in the water up to your ankle, your chest. And we get on that beach, and you won't believe this. Women and children. I was in the invasion of Leyte, the Philippines. So we were the first guys come back. And when we hit that bed, women running, jumping on you, kissing you, hugging you. I had two kids hanging off my shoulder, and this lady is holding me and kissing me. Americano, God, she's kissing and kissing. And the guys, get off the beach, get off the beach. You can't move with all this. So when you'd be fine, you get it ashore. And then it wasn't so easy, but then, like I tell people, I said, you have no idea what it's like when you're soaking wet like that. Now you tell me, when they reverse those engines, what they bring all that sand up, and it gets in. Now you might go a day, 2 days, maybe 3 days without being able to change clothes. 98 degrees, the sun bearing down, soaking dry, and all that, like it's just pure salt, and it gets into your crotch and your shoes and your feet, and you're walking in the sand, just rubbing your raw, and you can't change. You guys finally get to take your shoes off. You take your shoes off, and the socks are full of blood. But the sand gets in between your toes, and so you imagine what it must be like. And now you go to the bathrooms. You're in a combat area. There's no toilets and nothing. So we went. I think it was about a day and a half. We're up in the lines. We finally get relieved and go back. And the guy says, you know, just you guys crap out. Take it easy. So he says, you dig a hole and you get into this foxhole. I mean, I was exhausted. I just passed out. All of a sudden, I wake up. I go up, move, and I'm soaked. Water in the foxhole up to my chest. I'm sitting there. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. And the night before, a couple of guys had got shot, you know, wandering around. And then I said, I can't. I'm holding a rifle up. But I'm not, by this time, you're freezing. You know, the water is going to make you cold. So I'm saying, what the hell am I going to get out of this hole? So I finally started out. Hey, it's me, Brody. It's me, Brody. And I started walking down. And I got into one of the gun pits. So the guy says, get on the tarp over there. Get on top of it. So I got on top of the tarp, and I just passed out. Didn't sleep enough, so dead tired.
What I'm hearing is all the stuff besides combat that was hazardous to your health, that was challenging, that was difficult. What about combat itself? Because here you are, a teenager. I'm sure your mother was worried sick back home in Brooklyn and praying her tail off.
We told a story one time to the family about the grenade. They come to me, and the sergeant says, hey, Boria. He said, I want you to report to the first sergeant. You know, so I pick up my rifle and peg. I go over to the first sergeant. And he says, look, you're the youngest guy we got here. We figured that guy, you can really run. We're going to put you out on the outpost. So about 1 o'clock, they send a guy that wakes me up and says, you know, so I get him, and he takes me out. And this is a combat. I'm in front lines. It's all jungle. So anyway, so they take me out, and they said, okay. The guy tells me, you got a grenade? I says, yeah. He said, give me. So I give him the grenade. He takes the grenade, pulls the pin. He says, open your hand. And he puts the pin in my hand. And I got this grenade. And I'm sitting there, and I mean, nothing. Nobody, it was just pitch black. And you sit there with this grenade. He says, if you hear anything, throw that grenade and get back here. So I'm holding the grenade. The guy takes off, and all of a sudden, now I'm shaking. One of the worst things ever is to have to do poo-poo in your pants. I mean, that's, you know, nobody's going to say you make, because everybody goes through this. So, you know, they know what it's like. But it's just a shame that you pooped your pants. You know, you've heard that saying how many times? Oh, you took that scared. And it's so true. It is. I mean, you got to be. So I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to shake, and I'm saying, oh, God, I'm really scared. I mean, and, you know, you're holding this thing, grenade, you know you're going to get. So I'm saying to myself, if I keep like that, this thing is going to go off. They have a bird. I don't know what the name of that bird is, but it screeches. At the night, when that bird let that screech out, I thought I had busted through my. I were rolled over, and I'm squeezing that grenade so hard, I thought I was going to crush it. And I mean, I'm talking about shaking, and I'm rolling over, and I'm thinking of my mom, I want to get the hell out of here. But anyway, I started to pray, and the next thing you know, I was just calmed down. I mean, just like I'm sitting here just like this, with that grenade in my hand, and just sat there like that, and I'm saying to myself, Jill, thank you, go ahead. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And then the next thing you know, this guy's coming. Boria, I said, come on, come on, come on. He said, you got the grenade? He says, yeah, get it. He takes the grenade. He said, get down. And he throws the grenade. I just stood there staring at him. He said, you did what you're supposed to do now. Come on, get back here. I couldn't believe that there's a dead bastard there all this time. And he comes and takes it and he throws it. And like if nothing. So I got back hanging around. And so one of the guys says, hey, I hear you've been a big hero. Said, what the hell are you talking about, big hero? I ain't no big hero. He said, yeah, the sergeant's talking about how you kept the grenade. You didn't throw the grenade and you got back and such and that. He says, everybody's saying, you're crazy. He said, I would have thrown that grenade and run and get back here. Who the hell would have known the difference? I said, you know that? I said, that was my manhood. That was my map. To me, that was the greatest thing I ever did in the Marine Corps. You know, go down that way, you know what I mean? There were many other times that I was scared, but this time it was special. It was that I overcome that, and so it was a great feeling.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, more of Lou's World War II memories, as well as experiences from the Korean War, and how he ended up on the front page of a major newspaper. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Lou Boria, is one of approximately 65,000 Americans of Puerto Rican descent who served in World War II. Life as a Marine in the Pacific was no picnic.
At night in the Pacific Islands, it was the worst. The Japanese soldiers were top. I mean, they were the best. I don't know whether a lot of the people said maybe they used to give them, you know, narcotics or whatever. But usually anywhere from 6 to 7, Japs would come sneak through the night. And they had no weapons except for a knife. So they wouldn't be able to make any noise or anything else and creep up and get into foxholes. You used to have to get a guy that you knew that you're going to get into that foxhole with you that wouldn't fall asleep on you. So it's hard to find, especially in exhausted and with the sun beating down on you. It wears you down. So you're getting, you know, you want to go plop out. It's 100% watch. So one guy's got to stay awake. And you want to sleep, but you worry about that guy. Is he going to stay awake or wind up getting your throat cut, you know? So and that's that. And the mosquitoes, they eat you up alive. I mean, it was miserable. But you didn't get to eat. I mean, outside of rations, in the mornings, it would be the only time I probably could. At night, you couldn't start a fire to warm up. So you had no way to heat those rations. So everything is to, I don't know if they put a spoonful of spaghetti with meat sauce at 1 o'clock in the morning is ice cold. Did you ever try that? So like I said, it's horrible. I think that was the worst part. And in the Philippines, and I had the job that shotgun, they call it a shotgun, the officer that did the spotting for the artillery. So they would put a guy, and you stay with that officer. You help him carry his stuff and protect him while he's sighting in, giving positions, you know. So anyway, we're in this thing about maybe 4 or 5 days. I'm out there with this guy. And he's got this, and so I'm behind him, and all of a sudden there's an explosion. I don't remember I remember it. They got me down to sick bay, and I'm there, and they're bleeding my ears, blood running down my ears anyway. So they put a tag on me and said, you got to get this guy evacuated. So they put me on a LSD, and they took me out to the hospital ship. I get out to the hospital ship, and the guys help me out and get out. I get in front of the nurse station. So she says to me, you stink. She gets up and gets a pair of scissors and starts up from the top of my shoulder, and I'm standing there, and she's cutting away. my clothes, my underpants, everything. And the guy, he said to call me, help him take my boots off and the socks and take him into the shower. So the guy brings me in and take a shower. Would you believe, I think I slept for 2 days. She said, we thought, you were dead. You go over and check me every now and then. She said, no, don't wake him. Let him sleep. So I must have slept. I think 2 days of sleeping like that. But anyway, that was it. Then they took me to a hospital in New Caledonia, one of the islands. I stayed there for a while. They took me to Hawaii, a hospital in Hawaii. It was beautiful, but I couldn't get no time to go into town. You know, I couldn't walk. I was dizzy all the time. So anyway, then they sent me to a hospital in North Carolina. I was there for a couple of weeks, and the war ended. So then they discharged me, went home.
What was the explosion? Was it a shell or?
Probably artillery shells, you know, because they get into positions, counter artillery to whoever gets on target. This guy was awesome. This guy was, he was putting shells in the pockets of the Japs out there. But I don't know whether he was killed or what, but I know I was, like I said, when I was two, I was in the hospital. The thing with Korea started. Next thing you know, on August the 3rd, 1950. I got called back. Got in the train going out to California and to Brooklyn, and we stopped. I think of someplace, I think in Chicago. And all of a sudden, the guy walks in with playing poker. The guy throws these newspapers on top of the table. I think, what the hell's the matter with you? Get the hell out of here. You know, we got the poker playing. So the guy's looking, they're all laughing, and they all probably throw the paper back on down. I looked, and it was me on the front page. I made the front page of the Daily Mirror. I was holding and kissing my son goodbye. He was 3 years old. And what I was jumping with joy that day. Front page. So everybody in the family, everybody on my friends, everybody knew that I was on my way to Korea.
So the first time, World War II, you're a teenager. Yeah. You don't know what you're in for. You gave us a taste of some of what you experienced. But now, I mean, if you're on the front page kissing your son, saying goodbye to a son that you don't know you're going to see again, how difficult was that for you to face?
Like I said, at the time, you're not thinking that way. But, you know, I love the Marine Corps. So I didn't feel that they were being pressured. I loved it. I was looking forward to getting back in the Marines. You know, it's just, I guess it's just macho. So anyway, so I get to California, and what we did was the first few days in California was loading ship, helping to load ship. From there we went. Left. And the next thing you know, my foot is going over the side of the rail again, and I'm looking, I said, and now I'm a sergeant, so now I got to go, I'm the first guy, and I'm hesitating, I'm leaning on the, come on, sergeant, move, and I'm looking at him, move, you son of a fool, you don't know what the hell's going on. So I go over the side, and like I said, we go through that whole routine again, and get on the beach. I think that was the time that I was telling you about the monsoon, so we were a day late, we were supposed to land September the 16th, but the rest of the division landed. And you want to tell you something funny. Later on, I find out my brother was with the 5th Marines, Item Company 5th Marines, and there was an island before you hit Incheon. There was an island called Wamido. 25 guys that were wounded, my brother was one, taking that island. They only sent, I think it was a platoon of Marines. They was only scattered, but they wanted to make sure they was secure before the Incheon. But we were late. My outfit, I was with the 7th Marines. We didn't get in. The boat that I was in didn't get in until the day later. So then the commander said, we'll put you guys on a 72-hour watch. 72 hours, no, just keep moving. MacArthur wanted to take Sewell so that Sigmund Rhee was going to have a big, and give him the keys back to the city. So they put us 72 hours. Sewell was unbelievable. I mean, they had apartments, and it's not like the war that we were used to, jungle. But this, they had apartments, and somebody climb up to the top of the bed with machine guns, dropping grenades. And so you had to go in and get them out. He says, look, we don't want you guys. We're losing too many men. He said, to get gas. So they get gasoline, throw the gasoline into the buildings, and then with a flamethrower, and he just burned these towns. You know, guys jumping out of windows. And I mean, it was horrible because it's not only the civilians, women, kids. It was horrible. And you go through, and we got to a place called Wijambu. They said, okay, we got relieved. So they put us on trucks, and we started to head back. We're in the trucks. I imagine almost 72 hours without just getting much sleep. And I just got back in the truck, and I mean, I passed out. And all of a sudden, the mortars dropped, boom, boom, boom. And I mean, everybody, whoa, they're all alongside the, like we're on the traffic, the lanes, but up on the side, and these about five mortars hit that. We bailed out of the truck and jumped into the ditch, and we're saying, and the next thing you know, there's another load of mortars dropping by. So anyway, I look up, and I see this tank coming down towards us. So I got up, and I started to run, get to the tank. I told the guys, I said, I'm not going to get to the phone. So I get behind the rail, and I grab the phone, and I tell the guy, I says, hey, 10 o'clock at 10 o'clock. He says, I got you. I says, okay, infantry. He says, I got you. So I let go of the phone, and I turn, and if I fired, I mean, I got caught in a blast. I mean, just rolled me over. I just lay there. The guys jumped out, grabbed me, dragged me into the ditch. And by this time, he said, look, you got blood running down your ears. Concussion again, but busted my ears. So I said, I'm almost totally deaf now. But anyway, same thing, wound up in the hospital. Boom. Oh, they come out, the commandant of the Marine Corps, it was a Thanksgiving. I was in a hospital in Japan. They said, we're going to put you back in the casual company, and you stay there and see what's going to happen, where they could know with you. So anyway, so the doctor says, I don't think they're going to put you back in combat. You can't go back into combat. So anyway, I get into this casual company, and they said, everybody outside for roll call, and they call. And he says, the commandant of the Marine Corps says that any Marine with two purple hearts is not to be sent back into combat. So he says, anybody, any Marines here with two purple hearts, report to the first sergeant's office. So we got there, was about six of us. They moved us into different barracks, and in a couple of weeks, they put us on board a luxury liner and sent us back to the States. I got back December the 15th. We got back to Treasure Island. They had a big parade and stuff, and they said, we're going to promise you that we're going to get you guys home for Christmas. I think it was the day before, a guy calls me at 4 o'clock in the morning, get ready, Marine. He says, you're going. They had the tickets, the plane tickets, and myself and this guy, this Irish guy, this guy, DJ Sullivan, he was from Brooklyn. We used to call him the leprechaun. He was about 5'4". Uh-huh. This guy had a silver star, a bronze star, and two purple hearts. I mean, this guy was a terror. So anyway, we flew back to New York together. I got to church 6:30 Christmas Eve. I walked because I got to church to where my mom's house is further down. It was easier to get. So this guy, Danny Sullivan, and I, we rode all the way. We flew to New York, to Washington. Then we took a train in Washington together to New York, and then we took the subway home. And so he tells me, Zuki, come and visit me. He just says, I got to go over there. I have to get killed by those Irish guys over there. Are you kidding? He says, no. So he calls me one day while we were home on leave. He says, you know, come by tomorrow, and I'll meet you there. So I get in, my wife, I get dressed, and we go, I walk in that door. You ever see that program that they had, where they had the music of dun 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 dun? I mean, that was everybody in that. Turn around and looking at me, Puerto Rican coming into this Irish place. I'm looking around, and I said, so the bartender walks over to me. He says, you Boris, you? I said, yeah, that's me. He said, Danny said he'd be here in a little while. So the next thing you know, he came down, and I mean, what a night. I mean, we drank and they food like you couldn't believe. What a great day that was, yeah.
Well, and what was it like? I mean, they went through all that trouble to try to get you home for Christmas, to see your family again at that time.
I got back, and they sent me to Quantico, Virginia, and we were training Korean officers. So one night they had a field problem, rubber boat landing. So anyway, we were protecting. These guys were going to invade. So we were all set up. All of a sudden, we hear them coming. So anyway, we get up, and we start trying to outflank them. All of a sudden, this Korean grabs hold of me. He says, you're my prisoner. I give him with a rifle in the chest. That's that guy sprawling. And I mean, I took off. I said, can you imagine a veteran of two wars and getting them, they march you back. And that guy got taken prisoner, but they never would have let me down. So anyway, so I got back to the barracks. When you're doing this, they have these guys standing around, and they throw these firecrackers as a simulating, making out like it's mortar fire, and it bounced off my helmet, What do you think? I wound up back in the hospital again. So the guy says, look, you've got blood in your coming down your side. They say, you're finished, you can't stay in the Marines anymore. I had to get out. So I said, now I don't have a high school diploma. I don't have no, what the frick am I going to do? I started to work different jobs. And I was driving, I said, the VA says, you can go to school, learn plumbing. And I said, okay, so I started to go to school, learn. And then they put you on a job training. And these guys, they had passed a law in New York City that any multiple dwelling building had to have central heating because they were killing people with the gas stoves burning and a lot of fires. And so anyway, so I went to school for that. These guys, they hire you to carry all the radiation into the buildings. You know, they start with the trees, and then by the time they get to the top, you're carrying radiators with 12 of them. I don't know eventually how much they weigh. So we used to put like 2x6 planks on the steps and then push them to the next landing and do that. But it was tough work. So anyway, one day I met a guy, and I'm driving this truck, and he says, look, why don't you go to Squibbs, this pharmaceutical company? He says, they're doing a lot of hiring. They got the penicillin, and the guys are working around the clock. So I got there, and this lady interviews me. She says, I'm sorry, but the only openings we have is for porters. He says, and I, with your background, I can't offer you a job like that. So I'm sorry, but if you come back, maybe like, so I said, no, I got to get this job. So I said, what does it pay? So he said, well, 150. I said, I'm making 150 and I'm working 6 days. So I quit the job and I said, I'll take this. So anyway, I went to work as a porter. Within about 6-7 months, I had worked my way up to a level 13. I started as a level 2 and worked my way up. And I was making good money 7 days a week. All of a sudden, they decide they're going to move the factory to Jersey. I said, I'm not going to go to work all the way out to Jersey. So anyway, so the guy says, you know, let's go around and apply for city jobs. So like I said, I don't even have a high school diploma. So I'm saying to myself, all these jobs, you got to take tests. So they says, they got the police, fire, and sanitation department, and transit. Those are the top jobs. The top job in the city of New York is fire. You work 72 hours and you're off the rest of the week. And, you know, and the police, you know, got good pay. Sanitation department. And sanitation department is paramilitary, which nobody knows. I didn't know that. The paramilitary. And you get the job as 5 weeks vacation, starting the job. 1 year on the job, you get 5 weeks vacation with sanitation. So I had taken the test. So I got called for transit. The guy tells me, the union guy says, Louis, you're gonna get laid off Friday this week. So you're going to get 7 weeks pay. It's so funny that I got called from transit, and that following week, I started working. So I never lost a day's pay. I started working with the transit. So now I'm a transit. So I'm working, you know, there for about a year. And I take the test for sanitation department. 30,000 guys took the test. And all the 30,000, all these guys, most of 90% of them are all veterans applying for this job. Where do you think I come in? Number 3 on the list. I was shocked. You talk about blessings. I took the test. I worked picking up garbage for about 3 years. In the meantime, I took the test. I passed the test. I became a lieutenant. Now I'm a dressed green uniform, same color, marine green. And I'm a lieutenant. And I can't believe this. I worked, I think, about a year and a half, 2 years. I took the test, and I became, now I'm a captain. It's unbelievable. Like I said, it's only the good Lord. He's the guy that put me through all this.
I mean, I could tell. I'm looking at you. You got a Marine Corps watch, Marine Corps belt buckle, Marine Corps shirt, Marine Corps necklace, Marine Corps globe and anchor on your hat.
And you can't see behind it. That's in the heart. That's where it's at. Uh-huh. And now, I tell you, I had 4 sons of Marines, and I lost my oldest guy in Vietnam. But like I said, it's been that way. And I feel that the Marine Corps has been the greatest. My life.
Well, I've had a lot of Marines tell me, once a Marine, always a Marine. I can tell that that's your mentality. But what does that mean to you? What does that signify in your mind?
To me, you know what? I do things. You could ask my wife. I walk to church. I'm 94 years old. See, I walk to church 8 miles. So everybody, I said, that's a Marine thing. Yeah. I cut the lawn. I do paint. I do everything. My outlook in life is like that. I think positive. I just don't. Yeah, I'm old. I'm aware. I mean, you know, I met my wife. My wife, first, we married 63 years, and she got Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So I took care of her for 5 years, and then she passed away. Like I said, I'm a member of the church, and my wife, Alice, she was a member of the church. So we know she came to my 50th wedding anniversary with her husband and everything else. And So by this time, I got 3 years, my wife had passed away. So the pastor of the church says, and says, he points to Alice, he says, that lady over there, she's a widow. Why don't you guys get together? He says, you got life yet. You did what you had to do with your wife. And I. So anyway, after the service, she came over to me. She says, you want to go to lunch? I said, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. So I said, the pastor talked to you too? She says, yes. So anyway, so we got together. We've been married now 5 years. She's beautiful too.
You mentioned something there I was actually going to ask you. Because of your time in World War II in Korea, I imagine that you lost guys that you knew, guys around you, guys in your unit. But you just mentioned that you lost a son also in Vietnam.
I do have nights where I got to get up. I can't sleep. I got to get up and she makes me a cup of hot tea and we sit and we talk for a while and just pray and get back. And I'm okay for a couple of months or so. And every now and then I just have a real nasty time. I haven't been able to get over that. The guys... It's 40, 50, 60, 70 years, you know. So, but there's this one incident that we were in Korea. And the fact that we don't have interpreters, so we can't talk with these people. They were on the road, and they're heading up towards us. You know, there's maybe about 20, 30 of them. And we're trying to tell them to stop. You can't. We're not going to let you through. But there's no way. None of us spoke, you know, Korean. So this officer says, you know, just fire a couple of shots up in front of them. So the guy gets a... turned over this, and they start screaming and they stop and they run back and all of a sudden the next thing you know they're back on the road moving back again. So he said, if they fire it again, they won't stop. And no matter how many times we fired, but I fired in the air. I couldn't shoot them, you know. So anyway, so they stop screaming and everything else. So he called over to me, Bori, take a couple of guys, get down and go see, you know, like with a couple of guys who went down. And I got it. This lady's standing there with a baby, blood all up. It was terrible. I haven't been able to get over that since. It's horrible, really. When you talk about war, I don't think people, they mention it, but they don't really know what the hell it's like, what they're feeling. All these things that happened to you, and this was 70 years ago. It's going to stay in your mind forever until the day they put you in a hole.
What was your son's name that passed away?
Lewis. Yeah. He was Lewis III. Yeah, he's only 18 years old. We went to the hospital. They brought him home, and they had him in the hospital. We walked right by his bed. Didn't recognize him. He was just like skin and bones, and he got hit in the stomach 3 times. They had done a double barrel colostomy, but he didn't make it. He passed away. It was hard. You fight 2 wars, and you say to yourself, and now I got to lose a son. It's hard. It's hard.
Here's my question for you, because you have a perspective that not all of us have. So your son from the Vietnam War, they're in the process right now of putting 36,000 names on the Korean Veterans Memorial in Washington. And at the World War II Memorial, it's gold stars representing over 400,000. You've been there. You've looked at that wall. How do we need to remember the people that those stars represent or whose names are etched on the other memorials? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
I'll tell you what, my feeling about all this kind of stuff. I've been a very fortunate guy. I was blessed. I came home in one piece. I look and see it, and some of these guys missing 3 limbs. I mean, and then being $11 a month, we could put this guy in a home. Why does it have to be that way? That's what this country should do. They shouldn't have to be asking people to buy. The guy's a tree, put him in the house, at least to show some respect and give him the guy, make him feel like he's still a kind of a man instead of just a piece of meat. I just get so upset about that. It just bothers me.
When you think back on your time in the Marine Corps, I can tell you're proud of it. You're representing the Globe and Anchor everywhere here. Is there something that you'd say, though, looking back over 94 years, that you're most proud of?
That I'm most proud of? The fact that I can put on my uniform and go on parade, a Apopka Day parade, put on my uniform, and I'll walk the whole distance. I tell my wife sometimes that I come, and I feel bad that I got to put my ribbons on, and everybody all is staring, and I feel kind of funny. She says, I mean, you got nothing to be ashamed of. You earned that. You earned it. So I said, you know what? She's right.
Lou Boria, 94 years young. Find photos of him then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler saying thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments, Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.